Turn on.
There we go. Hi, hello, hooray, hurrah. Once again, the Greg Proops Film Club takes to the ether here from Hollywood's most enchanting cinematic confabulation. The Los Feliz Three here at the Cinematheque, ladies and gentlemen. This is where you applaud. Hooray, thank you very much for coming out. Tonight we're going to show the 1962 classic by Louis Buñuel, Exterminating Angel. I don't know if you've ever... I'm going to turn the globe here to show you. This is a globe that, fantastically, even though it's a sphere, the countries are not all together there, since it seems to be from the 16th century. We're going to move it over to today's country, which is Mexico, our sister republic. And, let me just take out some... Oh, my goodness, what's in here? Ooh! The miracle of booze. Louis Buñuel was not only a genius and one of Hitchcock's favorite directors, he also drank with something close to a fervency. And I don't mean that in an alcoholic way. I mean that he was really, really devoted. I think one of his most fantastic quotes was, the demise of the aperitif is one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. So that's where we're coming from. Tonight's picture, of course, Louis Buñuel is from Spain. And for those of you who know anything about pictures, I always assume, because everyone here is such a cinephile, that people know everything about movies. But of course, there's people listening elsewhere, people listening on the desolate wasteland that lies between the coasts. And thank you. I'll be being snide all evening. You'll have to jump aboard anytime you like. The sarcasm train will never quit rolling with me. For instance, I was in Texas the week before last, and Texas is an awesome place for armadillos. And listen, there's just as many nice people in every state. That's something that I'm vehement about, because people here, especially your liberal contingent here in California, will say things like, well, I don't care about Alabama, or I don't care about Mississippi, and that's where a lot of my relatives live, and so I do care. And there's, of course, intelligent people everywhere. There's just also enormous douche canoes floating around the entire United States at all times in an armada. And sometimes they gather in the red states a little more than here. And what are you getting at, Greg? What I'm getting at is this. This tonight's picture, the director is from Spain, which is a country in the city of Europe. And he's part of that fantastic wave after World War I of Spanish artists, of Salvador Dalí and Federico Garcia Lorca, the amazing poet. And they all were involved in the Spanish Revolution one way and another. Louis Buñuel, our filmmaker, was basically the propaganda filmmaker for the Republican Army during the Spanish Civil War. And for those of you who don't know what the Spanish Civil War was, one, it's an awesome song by The Clash, and two, it was a testing ground for fascism in the 1930s, before World War II got underway fully. Or as we know, World War II now, the last four, the previous 4 years. So he was on the Republican side, which is to say he was an anti-fascist, which is something that I like to stress quite a lot during the podcast, because there are people who believe that there are things that aren't political, and I don't subscribe to that. In my view, and this is my view, since it's the Greg Goddamn Proops Film Club, and you can sit there fucking quietly and absorb, is that everything is political, from buying a popcorn to parking. And for the people who don't think that, I think they're naive. And not only are they naive, they're decidedly white. White people are the only people who say things like, well, I don't know why everyone can't just get along. Because white people won't let everyone get along is the reason. And so that's why white people often say things like that. And then, of course, being a liberal, as I am, liberals ask the wrong question all the time. They ask things like, why would people vote against their own interests? Why would people vote for someone like Orange 45 when clearly he's demented or whatever? And I don't know if you ever talk to your cousins, but it's easy to find out the answer. They hate the same things They're more involved in someone hating the things that they hate and punishing the people that they feel need to be punished than they are in their own self-interest. And if you think that's some sort of gyration or mental gymnastics, it isn't. Orwell, who also fought in the Spanish Civil War, knew everything about holding two simultaneous ideas, or two contradictory ideas simultaneously, and he called it doublethink. And that's what's going on with a good deal of the country. When I say a good deal, I mean, 30%, let's be honest. Really, the fascism in this country has never risen above that, and it's right about at that level now, having just been to Texas, Louisiana, Tennessee, Georgia, Arizona, and New Mexico. I can say with some assurance, it's still alive and well. You needn't worry about fascism. It's always going to have its fans. And there's always going to be someone to say that they loved someone, no matter how big of a Nazi asshole they were. Believe me, after Orange 45 expires and is shot off into hopefully the asteroid belt, there'll be TV specials about him in 5 years, about how great he was and how awesome it was that he couldn't speak and that he gibbered and that he sweated and drug shot out his nose and that he killed a million people and how funny and great that was. Much like people are sentimental about Hitler, who bears the brunt of quite a lot of things, and people get compared to him all the time, but it's really hard to be as big of a gibbering maniac as Hitler. And Orange 45 has come as close, I think, as America's really tried here. We're the can-do country, and we've really made a huge effort by having him still be running for president after having lost the last election and having really lost the other election before that. After the 2016 election, I was surprised Haiti didn't invade us to install a democracy. So Boonwell wasn't a fascist, and Dali sadly took up the fascist side. Now, if you don't know who Salvador Dali is, he was an immensely important surrealist artist. And in fact, Boonwell, I think, was a lifetime surrealist who was very good friends with Lorca. And apparently they used to sit together and Lorca would read him poetry, which sounds absolutely dreamy. Well, Lorca was executed by the fascists in Spain, and This is what can happen to artists. Art is a fragile thing. Art is here to reflect, and art is here to enlighten, and art is here to illuminate, and to make us all laugh, and to make us all enjoy the humanity that we share. And fascists really don't cotton to art, because it does all those things. Because art is a salve, because art is a balm, because art is a lubricity that helps everything move along, and helps us understand the world through metaphor and whatnot. And fascists aren't real big on metaphor, you might have noticed. There's like a flag, and then there's bad, and there's good, and stuff like that, which of course completely ignores the human condition, where there really isn't two sides to every issue, except when I divide it up that way comedically. Thank you. Boonwell eventually had to move to Mexico to get away from Spain and the fascism. And now, of course, we have Mexican directors that actually get Oscars and things like that. We acknowledge here, our sister republic, that Los Angeles being part of northern Mexico, and quite proudly, I always have people complain to me, and we were in Texas, and we were in El Paso, and there's a giant wall there, and people are like, oh my God, Mexico, Mexico. And I'm always like, Texas, come on, stop with Mexico. What would you eat? Because really, what is, what is Texas without Mexican food? Oklahoma. Someone went, oh, yeah, we got fucking edgy there, didn't we, ladies and gentlemen, with some Oklahoma jokes. There's Iñárritu and Alfonso Cuarón, who both won Academy Awards here, are both Mexican directors. And Cuarón made a picture about 15 years ago called The Children of Men, which is a very exciting and sort of action sci-fi film where it takes place in a sort of the near future where the world is taken over by fascists and there's no more countries in Europe. And strangely, the one thing he got wrong was England is still a country. In the movie. And Clive Owen is an office drone who ends up having to fight on the side of the rebels. And then he finds out, as so many of us do throughout time, that lefty white dudes are complete douchebag assholes and aren't to be trusted. And if given a full rein to their impulses, they will be the violent, misogynist, racist that they always are. Is there going to be comedy? Certainly, at a certain point when I deem it so. Buñuel moved to Mexico, where he had an enormously successful career, and then later in his career was encouraged by his friends to make a bunch of pictures in his 60s and 70s, which he did with some success. He won the best foreign film, which I don't know if that's still, we call it the foreign film category. Now we allow foreign films to sort of be, and by the way, foreign films have to have more than a certain amount of foreign language in them to be a foreign film, which is why, oh, Kittens, I've just blanked on the name of the movie. Jennifer, what was the picture with the? Anatomy of a Fall. You guys, did you see Anatomy of a Fall? Okay, thank you for going quiet on me there. I appreciate your feedback. Believe me, people who are listening on the podcast are gonna say yes out loud in their room or on their bicycle or wherever they're listening, in the tube in London. And that picture obviously has a foreign cast and was made elsewhere, but because they made the movie in English, it wasn't a foreign movie. You see how we work here in America. Or as people say in Los Angeles, here. Meaning Los Angeles, no matter where we are in the world. I have been in Edinburgh, Paris, Tokyo, whatnot, and had people say to me, you know, here, meaning we were still in Los Angeles. There is only one here to people of Hollywood, and it's here. There isn't another place. And when I tell them, oh, I go to other countries, or I go to around the country, or I travel around, and I don't really care about show business that much, they're like, but how can you leave? What if something happens? And yeah, what's going to happen is show business is going to be broken up into a series of streaming duchies who will war against each other until there's no more fun. Isn't that why we had the strike? To keep artificial intelligence from imbuing us with artificial intelligence. So he carried on making pictures in France and whatnot, and he won an Oscar for The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. And his comment on when he won the Oscar was, the Academy was made up of 2,500 idiots. And he won. The Oscars, by the way, were much more entertaining this year than they've been in years past. First of all, they moved like lightning, which was awesome. Second of all, the Barbie number was off the hook good. That was an actual moment that took you back to the old days when we had Terry Garr flying on a plane or Rob Lowe rapping with Snow White. The great days of the Oscar broadcast, when there was no reason whatsoever when someone gets out of the audience and sings a Barbie song, and it was really super awesome. The memoriam part, I take exception to. You don't need a dance troupe in front of a movie screen. Like, for instance, you'll notice when we show the movie tonight, Exterminating Angel, there will be no dancing in front of the screen. I have not organized a dance troupe. However, if you wish to break out into your own lefty dance groups as the movie goes on, that's absolutely not forbidden here. It's encouraged, in fact. In my opinion, the memoriam section should be a close-up of all of the artists and executives and filmmakers and musicians and whoever they're showing that have given their lives to cinema, and maybe we should get to see them and their face and maybe a clip of the movie they were in. It doesn't need to be a very tiny thing that's far, far away, because the whole idea of cinema is that your head is 20,000 times bigger. As Elizabeth Shue, the actress, once said, first you're on screen and then it's your butt 50 feet wide. I'd like to talk a little bit about how funny Louis Buñuel is. This movie is a surrealist movie, as almost all of his movies are, meaning not every part of it is going to hold together and make sense in a literal way. So you're going to have to go with the flow on this. It is, of course, a parable and a metaphor and a scathing indictment, as he almost always does, of the wealthy and the Catholic Church, which seem to be two running themes in Buñuel. However, Buñuel was known to be a pretty witty guy, and I've got a couple good ones here. Thank God I'm an atheist. Yeah. Age is something that doesn't matter unless you're a cheese. That is fucking funny. God and country are an unbeatable team. They break all records for oppression and bloodshed. Yeah? Oh, no. Boonwell knew a lot. And also, Boonwell knew how to make a martini. And I'm a fan of Boonwell's martini. I've given up the demon rum, but I, of course, heartily encourage other people to drink because it's good fun, and it can loosen up the corridors of uptightness, and so that you might enjoy yourself for a few minutes. And a lot of people make a traditional martini. There's people who still like gin. You know what? I'm friends with some of them. It's cool. I don't approve of it, but okay. I have nothing against juniper berries or any other byproducts. I'm all for the berry on its own, or in groups, as berries tend to grow, in the berry gang, as they were. I'm just not a big, I was never a big gin fan. Vodka was my heroin. And I prefer the vodka martini. Now, Boonwell, of course, would have been drinking gin martinis, but this is the secret, and I'm going to read you some of his recipe, and then I'm going to walk you through it, because you're going to want to make this when you get home. Or go to a nearby bar here and order it. Connoisseurs who like their martinis very dry suggest simply allowing a ray of sunlight to shine through a bottle of Neuilly-Pratt, that's the vermouth. A ray of sunshine to shine through the bottle of vermouth before it hits the bottle of gin. At a certain period in America, it was said that the making of a dry martini should resemble the Immaculate Conception. For as St. Thomas Aquinas once noted, yeah, I think when you have a martini recipe and you're quoting St. Thomas Aquinas in the middle of it, you're showing not only your erudition, but an enormous, mind you, he studied to be a Jesuit. And as the Jesuits say, give us the boy and we'll give you the man. Which so many Catholic priests have said over the years. As St. Thomas Aquinas once noted, the generative power of the Holy Ghost pierced the Virgin's hymen like a ray of sunshine through a window, leaving it unbroken. And this is where the gin hits the berry, as it were. Another crucial recommendation is that the ice be so cold and hard that it won't melt, since nothing's worse than a watery martini. I would agree. Other than sitting behind white guys on public transport. For those who are still with me, let me give you my personal recipe, the fruit of long experimentation and guaranteed to produce perfect results. The day before your guests arrive, put all the ingredients, glasses, gin, and shaker, in the refrigerator. Use a thermometer to make sure the ice is about 20 degrees below zero centigrade. Don't take anything out until your friends arrive. Then pour a few drops of the vermouth and half a demi-tasse spoon of Angostura bitters over the ice. And this is the key, you guys. Stir it, then pour it out, right? You're not leaving the vermouth and the bitters in the shaker. Keeping only the ice, which retains a faint taste of both. Then pour straight gin, or in this case vodka, over the ice, stir it again, and serve. I'm an olive girl. I would go with olives, but of course people go onions, sometimes lemon peel, which is pretty fucking sexy. If you're gonna go lemon peel, I would suggest wearing an ascot, and if I were the girls, flats. Yes, flats. It helps you stay straighter after you've drank three of them. The thing about martinis is, what did Dorothy Parker say? After one, after two, I'm under the host. Gustavo Alatriste produced this picture at the behest of his wife, Sylvia Pinal. Sylvia Pinal, who's in this picture, and you'll see her as one of the stars, is still alive, my darlings. And she actually sought out Boonwell to make this movie. And she's a doyen, if you will, of Mexican cinema, and has been an activist and active in Mexican cinema for a million years, and was also in telenovelas and whatnot, and working up till a few years ago. She's in her 90s, as far as I know. Very, very exciting. This is a picture that came out in 1962, and I know for a lot of you it's ancient history, and thank you for coming out to a black and white movie. I keep seeing things on social media like, what black and white movie would you recommend to people who don't like black and white movies? And first of all, I'd say, if you know anyone who doesn't like black and white movies, you mustn't speak to them ever again. And if they really, the reason why they can't watch it is because it's not like real life, point out to them that real life is not like real life, and that looking at your phone all day is not real life either. That it's a magic little box, a rectangle that sucks you into it because all your friends live in there, all your imaginary friends. Real life is right now. We're talking to each other. And you're like, fuck, really? That's as far as it goes? Yep. Sadly, we've reached the pinnacle. Human interaction is real life, and everything else is cod, as we say in England. What does cod mean? Fake. I'll explain the slang as we go along. 1962 was not a terrible year for motion pictures all around the world. Sanjuro, the sequel to Yojimbo by Kurosawa, To Kill a Mockingbird, which seems to be, as I travel around the country and ask people, one of the only books everyone's read, which, hooray, it's an important book. You should read other books, of course. But To Kill a Mockingbird was made that year and is a superb motion picture. The Manchurian Candidate, which I think we lived through, except he wasn't Manchurian necessarily, more Russian, I should say. And Running Again, my darlings, Running Again. The idea that a candidate can be placed by a foreign entity in the United States, take control of the United States, and turn it into a fascist regime happened while we were all alive, and we all watched it happen. And now they're feeding us the, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Yeah. Yeah. 4 years ago, we weren't in this room together because we weren't allowed to be, because we were hiding in our homes because there was a deadly fucking plague that was let loose by a madman who threw away the plague handbook that Obama had left him that had kept us from living the way we survived through SARS and Ebola, which were also deadly plagues in other places. It is exactly because Republicans let the COVID take over the United States so that a million people died. It is exactly that. There's not some other vague theory or, oh my God, you're entitled to your opinion. This isn't my opinion. This is a fact. If you believe something else, hooray for you. And you can go live with my cousins in Sparks, Nevada. So yes, we are better off than we were 4 years ago. We have money, we're here having popcorn and shit. Two, we're in a room together, not afraid to be near each other and breathe each other's air and talk to each other. And that's not because Republicans did anything. In the subsequent 4 years, you may have noticed, they've really focused on things like gay marriage and guns and whatnot. And I always wanna say to them, it's not gay marriage and guns you should worry about, it's carbohydrates. That's what's fucking killing you. Take a look at yourself, my darlings. Lawrence of Arabia came out that year, which is a superb motion picture that I don't think a woman speaks a line in. I don't think there's one line by a woman in that movie. The Moroccan women in one scene ululate, if you'll pardon the expression, although I don't think you should. Ululation is quite exciting. And there's another scene where you see a woman's hand through the howdah, is it, of a when they're riding on top of a camel. But I don't think a woman has a line in the movie. And awesomely, British people play every nationality in it, which is what motion pictures were all about for a really long time. As you know, British people are often Nazis and Romans in movies. And as I've often said on the film cast, the whole point of American cinema up till the 70s was that everyone in America was Scottish-Irish, which is why Jimmy Cagney and Jimmy Stewart had such huge careers. So there we are. I've given you the recipe for Boonwell's martini, which is absolutely worth trying if you drink. If you don't, I would watch someone else drink it. This is a picture about the wealthy and what happens, and speaking of COVID, when you can't leave a room. I'm not going to blow the plot for you in any way, but I will say this. We live in an age where billionaires get a lot of play. They're often talked about in the media and on social media. People speak of them with reverence and things like that. When I say the billionaires, you know who I mean, Peter Thiel, Jeff Bezos, who rather than pay his employees a decent wage or do anything altruistic, his ex-wife is the one who's doing all the altruism, Mackenzie Scott. Jeff Bezos made a rocket ship for himself and wore a cowboy hat. Then there's Elon Musk, who is possibly one of the most insupportable people that's ever strode the face of the earth. I'm from San Francisco. He built a giant HQ there in San Francisco, and my assertion is that he's a sea creature who's risen from the bottom of the Marianas Trench, ergo his startling looks. And then there's Mark Zuckerberg, who runs the other social media outlets. One thing about all of them is none of them did it on their own. And not one of them had an original idea ever in their entirety of their lives, nor have any of them had an altruistic impulse. Much like the heads of all the studios in Hollywood, altruism isn't the driving force of rich people's lives. I know this doesn't come as a huge shock to a lot of you, but rich people don't sit around and think, how can I make the world better for everyone? They think, how can I kill one person each day till I'm the last person? And thank you. You're coming to all of my shows, the rest of the people in the crowd, whatever. The point of Hollywood, as far as I could ever tell, was exactly that, to isolate yourself at the top of a hill so that you're extraordinarily wealthy and successful and you really don't care about anyone else. And that's what all these billionaires are like. And so this is a very gratifying movie in a sense that it's going to show you the dilemma of what happens when rich people get together to really have a good old bitch about the poor, and then the psychological miasma that they find themselves in when they're confronted to stare into the vibrating, black, gigantic, raw, umber, infinite abyss that is the void where their human soul should be. And I think that's the fun of this movie. I know I didn't make it sound like much fun, but as my wife Jennifer, who curates this film club and chose this movie tonight, and I think it's a very pertinent for where we're at right now, because we're facing a giant election where we're literally facing the idea of renewing fascism in our country and or having an inclusive country that has things like black vice presidents that are women that are in the White House. And I know there's a lot of white guys here, and I just want to emphasize to the white guys here, that's important. I know for you, you're a white guy, you're like, I don't get it, I don't like her. I know. Your pee-pee hurts, your mommy was mean. I understand. That's why you didn't vote for Hillary and why you like the old shouty Jewish guy. I got it. I fucking got it. So let's enjoy a bunch of rich people having a complete and utter total fucking Freudian freakout in tonight's awesome 1962 classic by Louis Buñuel, chosen by my wife Jennifer, The Exterminating Angel.